This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Russiagate is all that Democrats and other members of the War Party want to talk about. But the author of a new book says the whole affair was concocted by the former head of the CIA. A Black activist and writer from Canada cautions that the Great White North has its own history of racial repression and police brutality. And Mumia Abu-Jamal has a requiem for a fading U.S. empire. But first, Dublin, Ireland was the site of the world's first international conference against U.S. and NATO military bases. The U.S. has between 800 and 1,000 military bases around the world, and a military budget that equals all the other nations on the planet combined. The United States has taken upon itself the duties of world policeman, waging war by military or economic means, with no regard for international law. The U.S. is now the main military power in Africa, with an entire military command centered on the continent. Paul Pumphrey is a veteran Black activist and a founding member of Friends of the Congo. He told the conference in Ireland that the U.S. has been exploiting and causing mass death in the Congo for well over a century.
The United States has historically played this role in Africa from behind the scenes. But because of a new element in the geopolitical and economic arena of Africa, known as China, the United States now has to play a more overt role. The United States had been involved in the Congo for over 125 years, and in that period of time, never built one school, never built one hospital, never even built a road. But it did supply Mobutu with hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars worth of military equipment to keep him in power inside the Congo, so that they have access to looting the riches of the Congo. But then that changed when they discovered the power of coltan, coltan being a mineral that's used in every type of sophisticated electronic equipment on the earth today. And they figured out that the Congo had 64% of all the coltan in the world. So whoever controlled coltan in the Congo controlled not only the electronic industry, but the financial might of the world. And at that point, they realized that their puppet that they had put in power in the Congo was too greedy. And if he had figured out the value of coltan, there was no way that U.S. corporations could get an advantage over getting this raw material cheaply. So they sent over envoys to Mobutu and said, hey, guy, you got to leave. We've given you 32 years of power where you were allowed to loot the country and do our dirty work, but now you have to go. And Mobutu said, no. This is my country. Under the constitution of this country, I am the owner of this country. How dare you tell me to leave my own home? So they had to move to plan B, which was militarily take them out. Interestingly enough, the United States had only one ally that they could figure out to carry out that mission, which happened to be Museveni in Uganda. And so they decided they had to get him some support. They could, I mean, after all, Uganda's what, 1/20 the size of the Congo? You know, maybe 1/10 the size of the population of the Congo? that wouldn't look possible that just one little small country could take on the Congo. So the United States orchestrated a war in Rwanda. How did they do that? They recruited the head of intelligence of the Ugandan army, who happened to be a young man by the name of Paul Kagame, and flew him to Kansas at Fort Leavenworth and trained him and recruited him to work on behalf of the CIA. Now, the interesting thing about Paul Kagame was that at the age of 3, his family was pushed out of Rwanda, and he ended up in Uganda. So, of course, his first language was English, not French. And when he went back to Uganda, he then recruited the other Rwandans who helped Museveni win his military coup in Uganda a number of years earlier. And they began to go across the border from Uganda into Rwanda and attack police stations, military barracks, schools, etc. Then George Bush I lost the election to a guy by the name of Bill Clinton. So when Clinton comes to power, what does he do? He calls for a peace negotiation between the warring factions in Rwanda and Burundi. And he invites the president of the Congo, Mobutu, the president of Kenya, the president of Rwanda, and the president of Burundi to come to Tanzania so they could have a powwow and see if they could meet with these rebels and resolve this problem. And when they did that, and they came up with an agreement, the plane that the U.S. provided for the president of Rwanda and Burundi, the two presidents got back on that plane to fly back home. And interestingly enough, a USAM missile blew them out of the air. That's what led to what most people now know as the Rwandan genocide. But then we look a little further and looking at how the United States uses its military might. They now have two countries that can push Mobutu out of power. By the way, Mobutu and the president of Kenya refused to go to that meeting. So Mobutu was still alive at that point. And after Rwanda lost 800,000 people. And let me make something very clear here. Out of the 800,000 that lost their lives in Rwanda, every independent study of that war shows that at least 600,000 of them were Hutus, not Tutsis. So it wasn't a genocide against Tutsis in that war. But secondly, that you had a situation where the government of the newly formed government of Rwanda at the 1994 lines up with the government of Uganda in 1996, about a year and a half later. Now, understand something. The army of Rwanda were mostly people who were members of the army of Uganda, who were Tutsis, who had come back into the new government set up after the war in Rwanda. So they recently came into Rwanda for the first time, or after maybe, like Paul Kagame, left at the age of maybe 3 to 5 to 10 years old. They had been out of the country for many years. Now they're going to be able to create an army matched up with the army of Uganda and march across the border from the eastern part of the Congo to go to Kinshasa to overthrow Mobutu. Now, understand the Congo at this point. The Congo has no roads between the eastern part of the Congo and Kinshasa. Uganda has no air force. Rwanda has no air force. So how in the world did these armies make it to Kinshasa? I have to share a personal point here. I was a co-founder of the anti-apartheid movement USA, and in that role, I did a number of speaking engagements around the United States with a gentleman from Namibia by the name of Thiel Bengerab, who, when Namibia got his independence, became their first prime minister. In 2006, I paid a visit to Ben in Namibia, and I told him I had just come from the Congo. He said, Funny you should tell me you came from the Congo. Let me tell you what happened in 1998. In 1998, because the person that was installed as president after they got rid of Mobutu in 1996, as president of the Congo, was a guy by the name of Laurent Kabila, who had been a Congolese freedom fighter who had fought against Mobutu 30-some years earlier, but had been out of the country for at least 28 years. And really didn't understand what was going on in the country when he was installed as president, supposedly by Congolese rebels, but in reality, the army of Uganda and Rwanda. Is that after he got into his country, he began to realize that the government of Uganda and Rwanda was stealing more minerals and selling it on the international market from the Congo than he was able to sell on the international market. And being a nationalist, he decided, that's not going to happen. So he said to the army and government of Uganda and Rwanda, thank you very much, but goodbye. You're going to have to go home. And he created his own army of Congolese that escorted Uganda and Rwanda to their borders and told them to stay on their side of the border. So now he's got a Congolese army along the border in 1998. And of course, the United States decided this is not acceptable because we don't know what this guy may do. He may just be selling to the highest bidder, which may mean China. We want control over those minerals. So the second war gets started in 1998 inside the Congo. And interestingly enough, the army of Uganda and Rwanda ends up in the central part of the Congo. Yet the Congolese army is along the border between Uganda and Rwanda, and they didn't march across the border, and they don't have an air force. And Ben explained to me how they got there. The foreign minister, the guy that had been the foreign minister of Namibia, he said after they got there, it was clear that the army from the Congo could not prevent them from getting to Kinshasa. So the president of the Congo called Zimbabwe, called Namibia, and called Angola and asked for military assistance. And they provided it. And so they defeated the Ugandan and Rwandan troops in the central part of the Congo. And Ben, as foreign minister of Namibia and the foreign minister of Zimbabwe, was flying in a helicopter surveying the situation because they knew they were responsible for these defeated troops, when all of a sudden, they get a phone call from the deputy foreign minister of Zimbabwe saying, Madeleine Albright wants to talk to you, boss. And he says, tell her I'm busy. He says, no, she's calling every 5 minutes. She wants to talk to you now. So he takes the call and puts it on the speaker phone. And Ben's listening to the conversation. Madeleine Albright is asking for permission for the United States to be given permission for air rights so they could send the transport planes back into the Congo to pick up the troops from Uganda and Rwanda, the ones they had left off. So if anyone has a question as to what the role was going on in the war in the Congo, where Rwanda and Uganda killed, by UN estimates, from 1996 to 2006, over 6 million people, in which over 3 million of those who were killed were children below the age of 5, we can understand what happened. And so here's the U.S. government coming to a conclusion that they no longer can depend on Uganda and Rwanda and other troops to do their thing. And so George Bush decides to start African Command and for the United States to overtly, for the first time, take the lead role in controlling what's going on in Africa. But the thing that happened, though, was that George Bush wasn't a very popular person amongst African leaders, so he was only allowed to have only 3 military bases built in Africa during his whole administration time. So what does big business do in the United States? They put the money behind a guy by the name Barack Obama. And for the 8 years that Obama was in office, African Command went from 3 military bases to 84 military bases in Africa. And many people or my friends were trying to wonder why I was opposed to Obama becoming a president of the United States. But that's a reality. And so we have a situation now that the map was showing earlier of U.S. military bases all over the place. And I have to say to people, understand something. What comes first, terrorism or U.S. involvement? Look at Afghanistan. In 1978, when the king was overthrown, and the U.S. and Saudi Arabia started first supporting the warlords of Afghanistan, but then realized that the warlords were only interested in taking back control over the land that they lost when the king was overthrown. And they stopped fighting. And they figured that they needed soldiers, people who could fight the long haul. And so they started recruiting people from all over the world to carry out a war against the great Satan of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And so what did they do? They worked with Pakistan and the CIA, and Saudi Arabia provided over $40 billion in cash. That's how Osama bin Laden from Saudi Arabia ends up over in a cave, if you want to believe he was in a cave, okay, in Afghanistan. A man who had kidney disease and had to do a dialysis. You can see that, right? Him on a kidney machine in a cave somewhere. But that's the story they tell us. And that's what led to the building of Al-Qaeda and later on the building of the different groups in Africa as well as in the Middle East. So it's clear that this is a real problem. And it's a problem led by the capitalist desires of the United States. And of course, Europe are good lapdogs. We used to call Tony Blair Bush's poodle. But that's the reality. And so you have this grab for the wealth of the minerals. And they tell you places like the Congo is poor. Let me address that issue. The Congo has an estimate of $24 trillion worth of minerals. It has the second largest rainforest in the world. But not only that, it also has the ability, because of the Congolese River and that rainfall, that if you captured it with hydroelectric dams, you could produce enough electricity to meet all of the electric needs of the continent of Africa, from Cairo to Cape Town. It also has, because of its rainfall and its fertile land, it can produce enough food to feed over 9 billion people. This one country. And they're telling, more than the world, the world's only 7 billion right now. And yet they're telling you, it's a poor country and we need to raise money to help these poor people. No, we need to stop the looting. So at that, I will bring it to a close.
That was Paul Pumphrey speaking at an anti-war conference in Dublin, Ireland. For more than 2 years, the Democratic Party and most of the U.S. corporate media have been waging a non-stop campaign to blame Russia for the myriad social and political conflicts that plague the United States. They call their conspiracy theory Russiagate. Ron Ridenour is a longtime activist and author, now living in Denmark, whose new book is titled The Russian Peace Threat, Pentagon on Alert. Ridenour says there's nothing the U.S. military-industrial complex fears more than the prospect of world peace. He says the whole Russiagate affair is a misinformation campaign concocted by former CIA director John Brennan to rekindle the Cold War.
Peace is not an issue for the United States of America. I read somebody's comprehensive analysis of U.S. wars. I'm often writing about U.S. wars, and this person came up with 12 years since the beginning of the United States of America's liberation from England's colonialism. It's only 12 years the United States has not been at war. We're talking about maybe 650 wars or minor wars or major military interventions in the history of the United States. And of course, it starts with the Native Americans, the Indians, the 300-year war against the Indians. There are 30 million Indians in North America, not including Mexico, when the Europeans came. And at 1900, there were 400,000 left. So the peace is fake news. And the United States needs war. That's why it's the policeman of the world. The Danish media here, which I, of course, read and sometimes contribute to or have in the past, they don't like to take my stuff any longer. They openly, you know, endorse and support the United States as the world's policeman. And they think that this protects them somehow.
But in the modern era, with Russiagate, this anti-Russian hysteria, Russia has been put in the center of U.S. crosshairs in ways that were not possible since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. But, I mean, you know, the Yeltsin, they couldn't make a war against Yeltsin. I mean, he was their alcoholic lackey. He, with Clinton and Wall Street, plundered Russia. The 10 years that he was the leader, there was a tremendous reaction against some political errors or mistakes or sins of the communist era, the Soviet Union era. That's a long discussion on what are sins and what are mistakes and why they were made. But there was a reaction, and the United States came in, as they always will, and took advantage and basically captured Yeltsin and the economy of that country. So they had no need to make war against Russia at that point. They emptied its gold reserves entirely. The length of life fell 5 years in just the 10-year period. Putin came along and he said, well, you know, I'm no commie and I'm no longer in the KGB. There's no KGB. I want peace in the world. I basically just want sovereignty for my country, like many other leaders have wanted, whether we like them or not. People like Hussein and people like Gaddafi and Assad and many in Latin America. So that was his greatest sin right from the beginning. He even offered Bush, when 9/11 occurred, he offered him intelligence support to fly over his territory. He did a lot to encourage a friendship at the cost of lives in Afghanistan. You know, it's not like Putin, in my eyes, is any tremendous saint. But the good thing with him was that he wanted to take his country back, and he began to do it. And the economy improved with capitalism. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a communist economy or anything like that. And that, of course, angered Wall Street and the Pentagon and the deep state, CIA. So that's why Russiagate exists today. There are, of course, many things happened since 2000 when he became the president. But it's logical that designed to dominate the world. I mean, that's what globalization means. It's another word for imperialism, but it's an imperialism that will totally dominate the entire world. I live in a little previously peaceful country. I mean, everybody that knows just a little about Denmark and Scandinavia has thought, well, it's tolerant, it's peaceful. They've made a vassal state of all of Europe. There's 500,000 troops in Europe, hundreds of military bases. In Europe, after the Second World War, you know, still here.
And the anti-Russian drumbeat got a lot louder under Barack Obama. His Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, called Putin Hitler, which is the kind of talk that you don't do in civil, polite society, much less in diplomacy.
No, it's ridiculous that anybody can compare Putin with Hitler. I mean, who has he killed? I mean, we're talking about a man, Hitler, you know, who's responsible for the deaths of 50 to 80 million people, 6 million Jews, a million gypsies, etc. I mean, Putin hasn't it's not in Putin's agenda. There have been some local warfare within this the sphere of the Russian territory, what used to be Russian republics. You know, Russia has 12 bases outside of its own territory. 10 of them are in previous republics. 2 or 3 of them only have radar stations. China, for example, has 1 military base outside of China in a little land in Africa near a base. It was a French colony. France has a military base, and U.S. has a military base.
In Djibouti.
Yes. And the general in charge of AFROCOM, you know, he wants to have troops, U.S. troops, and U.S. military bases in every African nation. I think there's 56. And Obama started to get military troops and bases in some of those lands. So, I mean, the United States has at least 800 military bases in the world outside of 4,000 military bases in the United States itself in every U.S. state. I mean, we're talking about gigantic mathematical numbers here where it's just absurd to begin to compare. The last statistics on the official U.S. budget for military is around $800 billion now. But it's about $1.2 trillion. But even if you take the official U.S. budget, that is 12 times what the Russian budget is. If you take the unofficial budget, it's 18 times. If you take all of the military budgets of all of the countries that are U.S. allies, the Commonwealth, the EU, the Europe, and NATO, we're talking about such a gigantic gap between them and the three or four countries that U.S. has on its current war list, that it's absurd to think that anybody in China or Russia would begin to be aggressive against the United States.
And in fact, the increase in the U.S. military budget of this year over last year is bigger than the entire total Russian military budget.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate. Of course, I'm no Trump fan, for Christ's sakes, but actually Trump, you see the difference between Trump and most of the capitalists, or at least many of the capitalists, and those that support the Democratic Party, as well as many that support the Republican Party, is that he earned his profits by super exploiting the domestic working class, by and large. He made his money from buildings, and buildings have to exist in a particular place. And so most of these buildings were in the United States or are in the United States. So he was not thinking when he went into politics like a normal imperialist, you know, like going abroad and dominating everything. He was not at that point connected to the weapons industry. Well, just like every president that gets elected, the first day in office, the real leaders come into the Oval Office and they tell the new sitting president what the world is all about and what they demand. And so everybody in the military-industrial complex told Trump that he could not continue to be president if he didn't have some wars, you know. I mean, Bush had two wars. Obama ended up with seven. So, you know, Trump maybe didn't want to have too many wars. And he didn't want to have wars with Putin. And in fact, some companies that supported him, including Exxon, thought that they could make profit by not going to war with Russia, that they could be partners in the Arctic area with oil. You know, they could jointly make profits from trading with each other around oil. So, you know, but Trump had to break his initial thoughts and go with the military-industrial complex. Every president has. They killed Kennedy. Not that I'm a Kennedy fan. He was also an imperialist, but he was a rather clever and intelligent one. And he wanted to get out of the Vietnam War, and he wanted to change relations with Cuba because he came to the rational conclusion that a nuclear war would only be the way that you could perhaps win, but you wouldn't win when most of the Americans were also dead. So when he began to pull out, the CIA and the military-industrial complex murdered him. Well, this could have happened to Trump as well. Why not?
Vladimir Putin is an extremely popular politician in Russia, and yet people in the United States continually call him a dictator.
Well, long live dictators. I mean, you know, Christ. Plato said, you know, what is the best political system? Plato's answer was a benevolent dictator. I lived through and worked in Cuba for 8 years. I've written 6 books about it. I even got to know Fidel Castro a little bit. He read one of my books and signed his name, and now I'm patting myself on the back. But I'm telling you that Fidel Castro, in many eyes, is a dictator, was a dictator. Well, depending upon how you want to define dictator, let's say he was. I mean, the electoral process there would take another interview with me to explain. It's not all that simple. But there's no doubt about it that the masses of people wanted him where he was. And he, under his time in Cuba, you know, nobody died of starvation in Cuba. Everybody had, quote, free education and free health care. Of course, you pay for this with your wages. You pay for this by being a worker. The Cuban people had a much, much better life all those years than they ever did before the Socialist Revolution occurred. We can find throughout history people who have been strong men who have been able to be successful in creating a decent society for the masses of people.
But Russia has multi-party elections, and Putin comes out way on top every time he runs.
Right. There were seven other political parties that ran against his party, including the Communist Party, which comes in second all the time. They do not contend that he's a dictator. At any rate, Putin is the man that the Russian people need, and Putin is the man that the whole world needs. He is the epitome of a dove. And my book starts with another dove, you know, with Yuri Gagarin, first man to go around the world. And at that time, Khrushchev was the peace man, the man who saved the world, one of the Russians who saved the world from a nuclear annihilation the year after Yuri went around the world. Well, Khrushchev sent Yuri around the world with a peace dove on his uniform often, you know, saying we have to have peace. Bobby Kennedy was sent by Robert Kennedy to tell the Russian prime minister that if they did not take their bombs away from Cuba, that was on a Friday, by Monday, there was no way that the military-industrial complex could be stopped from bombing Cuba and Russia. Now, Russia has never done that. Russia has never threatened anybody with a nuclear war. So I don't care, actually, you know, how you want to define the leaders. There's no democratic leadership in the United States' history. Everybody that has been the president is there to support Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. You can't be president of the United States unless you have many millions of dollars behind you. You and I could never be president of the United States.
So why does the U.S. corporate media and the Democratic Party not let Russiagate go away, despite the fact that they have not come up with any proof of the predicate crime, collusion?
Well, I mean, you don't need any proof. I mean, Goebbels didn't need any proof. They agree with Goebbels. You know, you tell a lie, you tell a very big lie, and you tell it over and over again, and it becomes the truth. I mean, how many people in the world, despite all of the possibilities we have today with communication, with the IT world, how many people will devote the time that you and I devote to try to figure out what the hell is really going on? You know, most people are workers. They have families. You and I probably spend many, many hours every week just to try to find out what lie are they telling us and how are they doing it and what is really the truth. And who is the corporate media? I mean, the corporate media, of course, is owned by the corporations. You know, the same people that own the media also are involved in other enterprises, including weaponry. The weaponry is what you can't have peace and democracy as long as you have a weapon industry that must thrive on profits like every other capitalist concern. And you can't have profits in the weapon industry unless you have wars. You have to use all those bullets. What they're doing with Russiagate is not just against Russia. And not just threatening the world war and nuclear world war, they are dismantling the solidarity of people. The so-called progressives were once for peace, too, the white progressives. I mean, now you've got white progressives involved with supporting Russiagate. You've got this so-called socialist Bernie Sanders, that son of a bitch. I mean, he's a traitor to everything that he was supposed to have stood for. He and I were together, not that we knew each other, in Mississippi in 64. He was a good guy then. Why does he have to come out to be an imperialist? Well, you know, that's you obviously win elections that way. You obviously get money for your campaigns that way. Bernie Sanders only opposed one war. That was Iraq. And then after he said no to the Iraq war, he voted every time to send weapons and troops to Iraq. And these so-called people, these so-called democratic socialists, they're the same way.
Some people say that Russiagate has inaugurated a new McCarthyism. Well, I think you're old enough to remember at least some of the latter parts of the old McCarthyism.
Well, it certainly is. When I started being an activist, it was in 61. The Bay of Pigs got me involved. I'd been in the military. I saw it with my father. We listened to the radio in 56 when the Hungarian conflict occurred. And Soviet troops came into Hungary. We know in hindsight, anyway, that the CIA was very much involved in making chaos and uproar in Hungary. Well, at that point, I was, you know, an American dreamer, and I quit high school and went into the military. I was sent to Japan, and on the military bases there, a radar base, it was totally segregated. White soldiers went around on that base in full uniform with a baseball cap on their head with KKK engraved in it. Well, for some reason or another, I didn't like that, and I protested. I was demoted. The barracks were segregated. And, of course, the prostitutes in the town, local town, which the United States had created, some could only serve blacks and others could only serve whites. Well, I didn't like that. They put me down in the snow and almost suffocated me to death. They burnt all the hairs off my testicles with DDT. When I came out of that, I began to wake up. What is it? What's going on here? What's going on? So when they invaded Cuba, I started to really protest. I remember Allen, Steve Allen. He was against the war. Every time he made a speech, he had to start by saying, I am not a communist. I am not a communist. This was at the end of the McCarthy period, and still it was so important that if you wanted to criticize some important policies of the United States government, you had to be very clean. You had to not be a communist. Well, communism fundamentally, I mean, at least the power of communism in the state sense, is not happening right now. So you got to have a new enemy. You remember Colin Powell's, one of his famous remarks when he was Secretary of State, he said, you know, I'm running out of enemies. You know, help me. We got to find a new enemy. Well, so they got terrorism. You know, they created terrorism. They terrorized people. So now you don't start your talks or your discussions with, I'm not a communist. You have to say, I'm not a fan of Putin. You know, so basically they're doing the same thing. This is the second Cold War, the second McCarthy time. Yes, no doubt about it.
That was author Ron Ridenour speaking from Denmark. Lots of folks in the United States think that Canada is a country of racial tolerance. But Robin Maynard, a black activist based in Montreal, Canada, says, don't believe the Canadian hype. Maynard is author of a new book titled Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada, From Slavery to the Present. She says there's more to policing and repression of black lives than just brutal cops with sticks and guns.
Something that was really important in the project of Policing Black Lives was to look at the way that racialized surveillance and racialized punishment is actually something that extends far broader across our society. So we can look, of course, to the treatment of racial profiling, of what are called in the United States stop and frisk, and what's called carding or street checks in Canada with police, and of course, you know, the extreme rates of incarceration of Black and Indigenous communities. But I think we also need to understand the ways that surveillance extends as well beyond the police, in terms of the ways that Black families, for example, poor Black families are monitored in particular ways by Child and Family Services and are really seeing, you know, their children taken away at rates that drastically surpass those in white populations. We also see, for example, the way that Black youth are being treated in schools, the way that their movements and actions are being disciplined, the way that they're subject to higher rates of suspension and expulsion. So my work was really engaged in really looking at the ways that exactly what I'm calling policing is actually something that is built into not only the system that we really consider a repressive force in our society, which is, you know, law enforcement prisons, but that it's actually, for Black people in particular, something that is spread across multiple state institutions, and that we can really trace that history back to something that really began, you know, upon the abolition of slavery. We really see that these mechanisms of racialized control and surveillance and punishment were really spread across a multiplicity of public institutions and are actually part of many aspects of everyday life for Black people as a result.
And so these other processes should be lumped in with policing because they have the same purpose.
I think that it's really helpful in terms of what it means for us to be moving towards Black liberation, to be moving to an end to racial injustice, for us to really be able to look at the all-encompassing nature of it if we're really going to create or to try to create transformed societies in which we're not seeing, you know, ongoing racially disproportionate harms across the board. We really need to look to that kind of anti-Black racism and surveillance wherever it's taking place in order to interrupt it.
That's interesting because most people have the impression that Canada's policing of the conventional kind is not as racially tainted or as violent as in the United States, and that its social welfare systems are more benign.
Canada is a different country than the United States in terms of different parts of its economy and the way that healthcare is structured. But if we look at the rates in which Black people, for example, are dying at the hands of police, we see that, you know, some study shows that Black people are three times more likely to be killed by the police, right, in provinces like Ontario and across the country. CBC, Canada's national media, just did a major investigation and found that both Black and Indigenous populations were being grossly disproportionately impacted by police killings. We see measures in Montreal and Kingston, in Halifax, in Lethbridge, Alberta, that show us that Black people are being stopped at rates that are between, you know, 2 to 4 times higher than that of white populations, that Black people are incarcerated at a rate that is 3 times higher than that compared to their rate in the general population. So we need to understand that although Canada has a particular reputation of racial benevolence, that of course, you know, the government and the state have a particular investment in selling in an international way in terms of, you know, raising a particular kind of international reputation, the realities for Black people on the ground are often being subject to, you know, really horrific kinds of violence. I'm thinking, for example, of Abdizaman Abdi, who was a Somali man who was beaten to death by the police in Ottawa in 2016, or more recently, the police killing of a young father, Nicholas Gibbs, in Montreal that happened, you know, just not long ago, just this year, right? So we really need to look at this issue in a way that I think pushes aside that idea of Canada as only the end of the Underground Railroad. And we need to look to what really, you know, the history and the present reality is of this country. And that includes, you know, a long legacy of, you know, 200 years, over 200 years of the legal support for slavery, of segregated schooling, which, you know, in Nova Scotia, the last segregated school in Canada closed in 1983, right? So these are historical legacies that have not really been reckoned with in important ways that are still really impacting the ability of Black people to move freely in public space, to access any public institution in the present moment.
Is Canada getting more like the United States, or has it always been a racially divided country?
Well, I think that as opposed to comparing to the United States, I just think it's really important to say that Canada has its own history, you know, as I mentioned, of slavery, of segregation, of racialized policing. You know, one of the stories of a police killing that I found dated back to, I think it was 1946, of a Black man that was killed by the police in Nova Scotia. So it's not a matter of, is Canada starting to mimic the United States? It's a matter of saying that Canada has a long history of racialized surveillance, of racialized violence, you know, towards Black communities and towards Indigenous communities that has perhaps been better hidden. Anti-Blackness is also a global issue, right? It's not something that stops at the United States border. The legacy of the transatlantic slave trade has left, you know, a few parts of the world untouched. So we can see, you know, disproportionate harms, you know, not only in Canada and the United States, but we see this in the United Kingdom. We see this in Brazil. So we really need to understand that this is, in many ways, a globalized reality, that it's absolutely not something that's exceptional to the United States.
The nature of the Black community in Canada has changed. Until relatively recently, the center of Black population was in Nova Scotia, where thousands of ex-slaves from the United States who sided with the British in the U.S. Settler War of Independence were settled by the British. But now the Black population comes from everywhere.
Sure. I mean, one thing to also note is that we often look at, you know, what's called the Loyalist Migration as a time when enslaved Black people were liberated by the British and brought across the border. But what we need to remember is that at the same time, white Loyalists actually brought thousands of enslaved Black people across the border with them. So just to remember that sometimes the stories that seem liberatory, if we look more closely at the lived conditions of Black people, we realize were very different. And also that many of those Black Loyalists that arrived in Nova Scotia who were promised land, you know, equal to that of the white settlers, received nothing or almost nothing, right? And were in conditions that many historians have compared to near slavery and servitude because of that. So that's really just to undo, I think, some of the ways that myth-making gets propagated in terms of casting, you know, a historical benevolence that I think we need to be careful about. But yes, so absolutely, there is a longer history, you know, of Black populations living in Nova Scotia, but we also have, you know, there was slavery in what was then New France, but is now Montreal, right? So as much as that's, you know, a much smaller part of the community, there is this long legacy of, you know, of slavery and of communities in Ontario, in what's now Quebec as well. As well as, of course, you know, since migration policies have changed in the later 20th century, we are seeing a significant amount of people who migrated from the Caribbean, who were, you know, enslaved by the British in the Caribbean, and later, you know, in the post-colonial moment, migrated to Canada. So what's interesting is that if you look across the board, if you look at the realities of African Nova Scotians whose families go back generations in this country, or if you look to the realities of recently settled, you know, Somali refugees, for example, we see that while, of course, experiences are never identical because Black communities are different and diverse and are really a wide and rich diaspora, we see that if you look to the measures of, you know, the push out from schools, if you look to the measures of, you know, disproportionate police stops, we realize that Black people are being treated very similarly across the board. And the way that we can really understand that is because of the ways that Black people are perceived, because of how anti-Blackness reduces Black people, you know, to this perception that they are criminal, pathological, and dangerous. So regardless of whether you're looking at, you know, communities that have been here for generations or newer communities, we still see, you know, significant rates of poverty, of incarceration, right? This really, I think, demonstrates the malleability of how white supremacy functions.
You speak of how folks outside of Canada are susceptible to the myth of a non-racial country, but how many white folks in Canada believe that?
Now, that's something that's really important because the idea of Canada as a racially benevolent nation, as historically benevolent as well as in the present, that's not only a myth that persists overseas or in the United States. That's very much something that is built into how the self-identification of Canadians in a very self-congratulatory way. And some of that really goes to, I think, the ways in which the Canadian public schooling system, the way the universities are educating the population, where we learn about the history of slavery in the United States, the history of the civil rights movement in the United States, of segregated schooling in the United States, but we don't learn about those realities in this country. I certainly didn't. So many Canadians have not learned until they were in university that there is even a legacy of slavery here. Now that's beginning to change, a large part because of the mobilizations of Black activists and Black community members who've been fighting to get this information into the public realm. So I'm thinking about, you know, historian Charmaine Nelson, legal historian Barrington Walker, the works of Renalda Walcott, Catherine McKittrick. There's been so much work to interrupt this, yet at the same time, it's been continually erased, pushed aside, invisibilized within the public realm in Canada. I mean, what that means for Black activists, right, is that, for example, the background that I have coming from a long-time activist commitment means that, you know, if you're organizing a demonstration after a Black person has been killed, there's this idea, you know, you see the headlines and it's, you know, Black communities allege racism, as if this is something that is alleged, as if this is something that's not a documented reality in this country. It makes it extremely difficult to publicly name an injustice when that injustice is not widely accepted as fact in the broader society.
And as an activist, how does the fact that Black folks in Canada come from so many different locations impact on organizing politically?
There's many different ways that affects organizing, I suppose. In some ways, of course, I mean, it can create a barrier in terms of just, you know, the very many different backgrounds that we are coming from. It's not the same life experience to be coming here from Somalia, from Jamaica, to have, you know, have your family dating back to living in this country for centuries. But I think that what that also really creates is a really incredible, you know, kind of diaspora learning and community building that shows that the Black community here is so incredibly rich and, you know, speaking different language, different religions, different cultures. So that's also something that lends to a real beauty in terms of what it means to be creating these communities, these opposition and this oppositional and resistance based movement. So I think that that's something that, you know, is both can be a barrier, but is also something that if we let it opens us up to so much, to understanding Blackness as not a fixed identity, but as something that is, you know, constantly shifting and changing, and that really that allows us to work together, I think, in different ways.
And on the list of complaints of Black folks in Canada, how high is policing in its various forms?
I think that has been one of the most public and visible struggles for a few reasons. I mean, if you just think about the very spectacular nature of Black people being killed, right? And of videos, for example, we have a video that recently surfaced of the police killing of Nicholas Gibbs. These are just things that horrify, right? The ending of a life of a community member is something that I think for very good reason really resonates in a significant public way and has often been sort of the linchpin of organizing efforts, of efforts against police stops, of efforts against police killings, right? And this is part of community activism that goes back generations, right? We're not the first generation to be fighting this fight. But I think that, you know, given also the long history of a lot of Canada's Black community being people that have migrated, there's also always been, or for a long time, there's been, you know, significant movements against displacement, against deportations, against unjust immigration policies that have also been a significant part of Black community organizing here. I'm thinking, for example, recent collaborations with Black Lives Matter, with L. Jones and other people in Halifax working to stop the deportation of Abdul Abdi, who had come here as a child from Somalia and been targeted, you know, by the child welfare system, by the criminal justice system, and eventually was about to be deported until there was really a national community mobilization that stopped this deportation, right? So there are many ways. And of course, there have been generations of Black families, of teachers, community members working to change the education system to allow for a decent education, a livable education for Black children. And most recently, I can think of the Black Lives Matter Freedom School that's been created really in order to create a Black-centered, a queer-centered kind of education for Black youth that they certainly would not be receiving in dominant institutions. So I think that while the most visibility, you know, in terms of the media always goes to, of course, demonstrations around policing, I would say that there really is a vibrant, really multiple and broad, different in every city in terms of, you know, for example, in Vancouver, we have brilliant Black community organizers who've been organizing against, you know, the displacement of a Black community from Hogan's Alley a few decades ago that used to be a Black neighborhood, right? So I think that, and that's really against, you know, displacement and against urban planning in some ways. So if we look to the really wide variety of ways in which Black people have experienced state and state-sanctioned hostility, we also see that, you know, Black resistance has been varied and rich and really across a multiplicity of ways. The one thing I just wanted to add is that, you know, when we are talking about the ways that I'm really theorizing policing as something that is this more broad and all-encompassing thing, I think we also really need to look to the gendered aspects of that. Because when we focus only on the idea of policing as being something that impacts young men in the street, for example, we're not thinking about the ways that, for example, poor Black women are the ones that are being targeted for the so-called crime of welfare fraud, that it's often young Black women who are being targeted by child welfare services and having their children removed, having their parenting monitored. So I think it's really important that we actually make sure that our lens and our framework for understanding racialized injustice allows us to see the experiences of poor Black women, of Black women who are trans or gender, or Black people who are gender nonconforming, Black people living with disabilities, Black people that may be involved in illicit economies. I think it's really important that we value all Black lives.
Robin Maynard, speaking from Montreal, Canada. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, reports for Prison Radio on the twilight of U.S. empire.
The Trump era, when it finally passes from the stage of history, will not pass either easily nor willingly. It will have left the aura of anxiety, the pangs of paranoia, and the air of enmity. It will be bitter, nasty, and mean, and it will not end with death. It will leave a stench of anger, of hatred, and sourness that will long dwell in the national unconscious, as well as the memory of the world. Such will be the legacy of Trump. Such will be the unworthy inheritance of the American empire. For the better part of a century, America played the role of protector of the weak and benefactor of the world's oppressed. But that was when the world was a bipolar one. The fall of the Soviet Union made the world unipolar, the world's sole superpower. And with that reality emerged the U.S. without a peer and without a mask. We saw then its true, angry, contemptuous face, snarling at the third world, hostile to to its European ancestors and dismissive of Latin America. That's because an empire needs no allies nor any friends. It needs subjects. It needs satraps. For empires are political, economic, and military machines of dominance and exploitation. Its power is its only justification for being. It matters little whether Trump completes the full 8 years of two terms or is there for the next 8 months. The die is cast. The empire has sat its utter contempt upon the world. The damage is done. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.